And we are back. Just a reminder, if you'd like to make a donation to If You've Got Ears and CKUT, you can do so at ckut.ca. You can also give us a call at 514-448-4013. Before we get back to the second part of the conversation, here's James Goddard's project Skin Tone with Butchering the Sun God from June 2017. On CQT, if you've got ears.
Can I ask, like, how did you like, because you were saying when you were growing up and you started taking guitar, that everyone was just playing like Iron Maiden and stuff. Like, how did you come to experimental music? How did you get away from Iron Maiden, or maybe not get away from Iron Maiden, but find something outside of Iron Maiden?
I think what happened was for me, because I have, for those of you who may not be familiar with me listening, I have one hand. I was born with one hand. So part of my learning process of just being able to do conventional things on the guitar came from a lot of experimenting with unconventional ways of getting conventional sounds, I guess, because I've had to adopt a different style of playing. So I was kind of performing experimental music in my bedroom since I was a teenager, since I was like 12 years old. I didn't know what that was, though. You know what I mean? Because I was trying to sound like Iron Maiden. And then I kind of got into Sonic Youth, and then eventually Miles and Coltrane. And that kind of, I kind of started to put stuff together. And I don't know if you remember, like, the Mars Volta was really big. This is like late 2000s, like 2010s. I was still in high school, and they
Left.
had elements of improv and stuff like that. So yeah, I don't know. And then I can remember being into techno, and then techno being kind of connected to noise, and thinking noise was this really obnoxious white people kind of music that I wasn't allowed to participate in. And then I started getting into noise because I felt like it was dangerous because it wasn't for me. And that there was this kind of strange attraction to it. And I think around the 2 or 3 years that I was getting into noise was when I had seen you play. And that kind of like clicked, where it was like, oh, like, experimental music is for minorities and is for not necessarily rich white boys from Berlin. Not that they make bad experimental music.
Well, that's it's interesting because there's definitely experimental music has a whiteness problem. Let's just put that right there out on the table and say it how it is. Because there, firstly, a lot of stuff that could be experimental music isn't called experimental music or isn't conceived of and approached like experimental music because it's not made by white people. And so there's something wrong there, and I don't know how to fix it. Or like my attempt to fix it is just to like insert myself into the space and be like, but I also think that on some extent, like whiteness is hurting experimental music and hurting noise because you do have this problem where it becomes, oh, these are people who don't actually necessarily have something to say. So if you're going to be playing with the edges of like the boundaries of what sound can do, it can become a problem if you don't have something to say with that. If you're not talking about anything, and I have found in my life that I'm less and less interested in the experimental music for experimental music's sake, or like the like harsh noise for harsh noise sake. I'm like, okay, because I definitely work hard in my music, and I think you do too, to use noise to talk about something, to use noise to represent conflict or some some of the darker aspects of humanity, and to talk and to address some of the heavier issues and darker things that happen in the world, and in my case, it's specifically to Black people, and I know you use samples from the Oka Crisis, and a lot of your work talks about specifically, the history of the Mohawks
in Kanesatake. And I think that, okay, not to be arrogant or whatever, but I think that that makes our music more interesting and makes it sound better somehow, even though obviously the conceptualization doesn't necessarily have to do with the sonics. I think that like having that framework also gives people a way to understand why things need to sound extreme. And sometimes just the like putting a contact mic on a buzzsaw just to like make a lot of noise, it's like at this point, or I mean, no, there's definitely creative people out there who are going to find new ways to make sound and new sounds to make, and that's true. I don't think I'm necessarily going to be one of them, and most people aren't going to be one of them. So it's like, yeah, we know what it sounds like when you put a contact mic on a buzzsaw. Like 30 people have done that already. And they've only ever played it in rooms of 30 people, but you know they've done it. That's the reality of noise and like experimental music. So it's like, if you're going to do that, now you need to go. I feel like this is a step that some noise musicians haven't taken. So it's like now it's time you have to take that next step, because noise music, there's conventions to it now, and so it's not you can't just push the boundary for the sake of pushing the boundary, because it's not even pushing a boundary anymore. It there's a form and there's a box for it. So then it's like, what are you? I feel like a lot of artists need to sit down and think like, okay, I'm making these sounds are painful. What am I doing with them? Why am I making them now? Like, let's bring a bit of sophistication into our reflection on experimental music and why we're doing it, as opposed to just like, you know.
Absolutely.
Anyways, maybe I'm being too derogatory of.
No, I think that's an excellent point, and I think it's something that we've both experienced. So it's not like we're coming out of nowhere with these ideas. Kind of on that tip too, it's mentioned before that you've been booking shows here for almost, we could say almost a decade, right?
Put on my first show in ever in the world when I was like 15 years old. It was like a food bank fundraiser, because you could like rent the hall and rent this PA from this store for cheaper if it was a like benefit concert or something. So it was like one of those classic Edmonton Hall shows. It was a punk show, and it was like, you know, $5 with a donation to the food bank, or $6 if you didn't bring a donation to the food bank. And so that's how it was a fundraiser or whatever. And I think maybe like the extra money, like the $1 if you didn't bring a donation, went into a tin that didn't get donated to the food bank, but got donated to Food Not Bombs. And so then I was like, yeah, 15, 16 when I did that. So I'm 34 now. I'm pretty sure I'm 34 now. So I've been booking shows for like 15, 16, 17 years, maybe. Yeah. Like 18 years or something, like most of my life at this point. I did a little small bookings in when I was in high school. And then when I lived in Sackville, we ran a house with Sackville's a really weird place, but we ran a venue out of our house. Because we lived in this, it was technically not termed a house. It was termed an estate because the property was so large, but there was like eight of us who lived in this like big old Shipwrights mansion. We used to throw these, we would throw shows all the time in the house. And then I booked shows at a couple of DIY spaces in Kingston, Ontario. There was a really, really vibrant space called the Artel. And then there was a building called the Mansion that actually famously Dan Aykroyd had owned at some point. And and used to have like the Blues Brothers car was like in the wall.
That's wild. There must have been some serious ghosts in that room.
Yeah, well, or maybe he busted all the ghosts and
So just on that tip real quick, closing out the interview here, I just want to ask your thoughts on maybe if you've seen any changing of the landscape, specifically in alternative music venues in the last 10 years, as far as getting, seeing more visibility, Black performers, Indigenous performers, South American performers. Have you seen any shift both in attendance in the audience and on the stage, and how much do you think in the future, how much has the internet facilitated a lot of these changes that we've kind of witnessed, in your opinion?
That's interesting. Definitely, like there are conversations that happen now that I like, even just, I remember when I was starting out to perform as Skin Tone, just before that, I believe Casey Majika was Quit Music, and Majia, I think, was quitting music from the Toronto indie rock scene. I'm blanking on Obiju, I think was the band name, and she wrote this sort of open letter about why she was quitting music and getting out of it. And again, her project was more sort of straightforwardly indie rock and indie folk, but she was very clearly racialized, and she really openly discussed why she was leaving music was because of the way in which her racialization impacted the way people talked about her music in a way that wasn't connected to the music itself, and so there was this sort of tokenization and fetishization going on that was leading sort of music journalists astray. And so when I started playing a Skin Tone, I made the conscious decision to call the project Skin Tone, because I was like, this is going to be part of the conversation that I'm playing this music. Like the fact that I'm Black and the fact that I'm playing music, like there's no way I can pretend, like I will even be able to possibly pretend that it's not going to be part of the conversation or related or somehow. So I was just like, I'm going to take control of the conversation, and I'm going to set the terms of debate, and I'm going to control that insofar as I can. It's changed so much. Like it's changed so much. I think that, the fact of the matter is that there's even now, like, it's hard to get a grant. It's harder to get a grant if you don't incorporate people with diverse identities into your projects. And like that's unheard. That would have been unheard. Like that was not people. White people didn't realize how white independent music in Canada was, or maybe they did, it's easy to, when you're not the only one in the room, it's easy to forget that there's no one else. Like, let me try and say that better. Like, I always know I'm the only Black dude at the indie rock show, or I'm not the only one, but I always knew when I was the only Black dude at the indie rock show, and you feel like you're the only Black dude at the indie rock show. Like that's what's going on. And that has a weight to it and a heft to it. If you're a white person, you don't notice that there's no Black people at the indie rock show. Cause there's no weight to that you don't feel that. It doesn't weigh on you. It doesn't present. And you don't notice if there's no, you know, Indigenous people, like you don't notice that you're standing in a, when you're white, you don't notice that you're standing in a room full of white people. you might notice if there is a non-white person, and that's part of why that is becomes weird. But I think that the people were not even ready or aware or like paying attention to those dynamics. Obviously, there have always been people, and there's always been a back and forth, and people have challenged those norms and stuff. And so I think people of color have always had long been having that conversation since, but something has definitely switched in the last 5 to 10 years from what I've seen, that even white people are now noticing that they're in rooms full of white people and questioning why that is, and trying to, well-intentionedly, not always with the best circumstance, but trying to figure out how to make that not be the case, and how, and I think that that's been interesting to watch that happen, because that wasn't even something that I thought could ever happen, that white people themselves would become concerned about the whiteness of indie rock or whatever, or independent music or DIY music and stuff. And there has seemed to have been some reflection happening and people are starting to have those conversations. I think there's still a level. I do think it's changing, but I do still feel like there's a level. I think on the side of performance, things are getting a lot better and a lot faster, because that's like way easier to control. Is just like, if you diversify your booking, like make an effort to book people of color, make an effort to book, queer people, to make an effort to book. This is a conversation that maybe we run out of time to have, but one of the uphill battles I'm still not great at it, and I don't know, is like, there's no accessible venues in Montreal. There's two, the Ritz and Casa del Popolo, of a sort of small size. Those are the two. Casa del Popolo, I work there, and I'm just gonna say it. It meets the letter of accessibility, like the legal code of what it means to be accessible. But when it's ram jam packed in there, I don't think that would be a comfortable space for a wheelchair user. I guess I shouldn't project, but as an able-bodied person, I find it difficult to navigate that space when it's full. So I can't imagine what it would be if I had barriers or otherwise limits to my mobility. And so so those are the two accessible venues. And then Brasserie, we have a ramp that we can put out, but we can't leave it out all the time because the city and stuff like that. We try when we can and how we can, but that's, it's also, there's no money in that space. And so, but even though those venues are nominally accessible, I think the Ritz is more successful at being physically accessible than the other two. There's not a single accessible stage. So what is that saying? That's saying that wheelchair users can't ever be performers, because no stages have ramps up onto the stage. And that's something that has been thinking about. I think that's the next, not to say that we're done with the race and the gender and the sexuality stuff. Like, those problems are not resolved and they still persist. And it's incrementally getting better. And I think, definitely people who put on shows and put on events are taking more care in their curation to ensure that the rosters that they curate are diverse. And I think that work is happening, but I think that there's still still something about audiences. I think that still lots of people of color, even if they see that there are people of color playing and stuff, I mean, I think that helps, are intimidated or are unsure, or as you said, like, they assume that's some thing that white boys from Berlin do that's not for you. They even if you're maybe curious, you're like, oh yeah, but it's not for me. And I there still needs to be more work to, I think, because I think the audiences that I see at a lot of shows don't necessarily reflect the diversity of Montreal. I wonder how to go about maybe making it more representative and seeing more different faces and introducing people. But I think that there's a huge problem in Montreal where we need to fix this physical, like I know that a lot of spaces we've lost a few spaces during the pandemic, but the spaces that we get back, I sincerely hope that we replace the spaces we lost with physically accessible spaces, because I think that that's a huge problem, and that it's really, really just bad for everyone.
Right on. I have a couple more things we could get into, but maybe we could do a part two at another time.
I'd love to set that up.
Cool. Yeah. Cool.
This has been really fantastic, James. I really, really thank you for your time and being so generous with that. And for the playlist section, I selected two pieces that I'd like to play from your catalog, if that's cool. The first being Such Loathsome Work.
Okay.
Which is one of my favorite things on the Skin Tone page. And the other one I thought that would be fitting, since we're both casts of people and we're missing live performances and also performing like specifically in the room, the cast of room that is now currently a store. So all you people out there, get your Christmas shopping done. Pablo Press, support Casa, support Kiva and Mauro.
Beautiful. Beautiful shirts, beautiful cards, beautiful books, and cribbage boards.
Yeah, yeah. So I selected Butchering the Sun God, which I guess is a live performance from Casa, I guess from 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to put that out there to for some of the people who are kind of missing the Skin Tone live experience or the Casa live experience.
But I would say that just to make sure that everyone gets properly credited, Butchering the Sun God was a live performance that was recorded by CKUTier and Casa stalwart Stefan Christoph.
Oh, fantastic. Love Stefan.
He's a huge champion of all sorts of local music and political causes and just a real asset to the city and the cultural sector in the city. And also I guess Such Loathsome Work is actually a duet between myself and Alex Pelchat.
Cool.
Hey James, do you have a Bandcamp or any?
Yeah, you can, if you go to Bandcamp, it's both my Bandcamp and my SoundCloud are sort of the same. It's Skin and then the numeral zero, Tone. And if you look that up on Bandcamp, that's me. And if you look that up on SoundCloud, that's also me.
Cool.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is If You've Got Ears, the Eliza Caution and Takeover Special Funny Drive episode. Thanks very much to Eliza for taking the time to do this with the radio station, and James for taking the time to have the conversation. We're going to run things down with a playlist put together by Eliza, some of her favorite Montreal musicians. It's an incredible playlist. Remember ckut.ca to make a donation, or give us a call, 514-448-4013. Thank you for listening.
bien ingenua. Si me ves con menos de 20 años, júralo que me vas a mantener. Me dices, baby, quieres que te ame, pero si no me vas a proteger, me vas a deber. Escúchame bien porque la cantidad de palabras que escuchas saliendo de mi boca es lo que vas a tener. Aguántame. Júralo, en más de 20 años yo ya he escuchado la cantidad de palabras que usan para que deje de sospechar que soy tan linda. Qué linda, linda. Qué linda, linda. Qué linda, linda. Dale.
Mi tesoro.
¿Estás ahí?
From Pacifico Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Maliheira Zozan. On January 1st, Turkish President Erdogan announced his appointment of Melih Bulu, a longtime affiliate of the ruling Justice and Development Party, as the new rector of Istanbul's Boğaziçi University, one of the Turkey's most prestigious universities. The appointment trampled a long-standing tradition of electing rectors from within the university. 3 days later, thousands of students gathered in front of the university to protest Erdogan's top-down decision aimed at controlling one of the few universities previously able to maintain some degree of institutional autonomy and academic freedom. In spite of government's heavy-handed response, resistance to government's authoritarian assault on academic freedom has continued. To understand the government's actions at Boğaziçi University, the ruling party's strategy for the institutions of higher education, the ramifications of this strategy, as well as the resistance by the students, the faculty and the staff of these institutions, Shahram Aghamir spoke with Elif Babul, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Mount Holyoke College, and Ayça Alemdurolu, the Associate Director of the Program on Turkey and Research Scholar at the Center for Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University. He started by asking Ayça Alemdurolu about the appointment of the new rector and the actions taken by the students and the faculty of the university in opposing this appointment.
The president appointed a new rector to the Boğaziçi University in the early hours of the New Year's Day, the January 1st. And then what happened is that the following Monday, this was Friday, the following Monday, students gathered in front of Boğaziçi University and they were faced with police blockade. And their demands were actually for the president to reverse this decision, to basically not appoint Mr. Bulu, this new rector, to the university. And they asked also to bring back the elections in universities, because universities in Turkey used to have a say in the election of their rectors until very recently, until 2016. This was not like a super democratic process, but at least the faculty, not the all the stakeholders in the university, but just the faculty was able to vote for their next rector, and then the university will send the list of people who ran in the elections according to their ranking in the election result to the Council of Higher Education. And then Council of Education used to send these names to the president, and then the president would appoint. The president has always been appointing university rectors in Turkey. But before 2016, universities had a say in who the rector will be. So the students basically asked to bring back the system and make it more democratic so that the university stakeholders could, I mean, the students and faculty and even staff could vote for rector. They started with two demands, but then later when their friends were arrested and detained, they also asked for the release of their friends. Currently, we have 7 people who are being tried for inciting hatred in society. These students were part of the Boğaziçi protest, and they were detained, and then they were given house arrest, and some of them were actually in jail. I think there were 2 that were released yesterday. Now they're being tried, but I think no one is jailed, if I'm mistaken. Elif, please correct me. So those were the basically 3 demands. Let's not have this rector, let's bring back the elections, and let's not put students in prison. Those were the 3 demands.
Elif, clearly the government and its security forces were prepared for a reaction or response by the faculty and students of the university. What measures have the government and its security forces taken to quell the protest?
There has been heavy police presence on campus. Boğaziçi is, most of the university campuses in Turkey are, in order for the police to enter into the campuses, they have to get the permission from the rector, from the president. Okay. And in the past, there has been events when the president's directors have allowed the police to come into the campus, and that has caused a huge uproar among the students. I'm talking about events 10 years ago or past events. So there has been police presence on campus before, of course, but it is something that needs the permission of the rector. So it's not a straightforward thing that happens. In this case, I think first started with police presence outside of the campus to make sure that students from other colleges, from other universities or other supporters are not going to hold press releases or demonstrations outside of the campus. But then quickly the police presence actually moved inside the campus as well. And the government also used the current situation with the COVID infection rates and the sort of curfew, the countrywide curfew, as a further excuse to criminalize and clamp down on the protesters. They used the infection rates as an excuse to say that you cannot do protests or demonstrations because of public health reasons, and used police to basically intervene in those.
Elif, unsurprisingly, Turkish President Erdogan resorted to the term terrorism once again. He characterized the protesters as a naive bunch mobilized by provocateurs tied to terrorist organizations. Concurrently, the pro-government pundits and media attacked Boğaziçi by characterizing it as an elitist institution. These are their words, suggesting that it is anything but democratic. Can you talk about the narrative promoted by the government and its supporters, and how would you respond to the charges of terrorism and elitism?
Terrorism has been a very useful tool, and one that is very swiftly, quickly deployed to condemn any kind of opposition to the current government. So we see time and again different kinds of groups who raise their voices against government actions to be labeled as terrorists. So this wasn't something out of the ordinary, what happened to Boğaziçi students and the faculty. They were quickly labeled as terrorists. And in the students' case, particularly in the students' case, they were labeled as young people who were sort of tricked into protesting by more experienced groups with kind of alternative intentions. And one of the things that happened was that the government representatives, I think, from the police, from the part of the police, they called the parents of some of the students to ask them to convince their children to stop protesting. When you take that into consideration, it's basically thinking that these students are not acting according to their own will. They're being tricked into protesting and behaving as such, and basically not taking them as interlocutors, as direct interlocutors, but instead calling their parents to ask them to control their children. So that is very much an example of how the government approaches the students, particularly as protesters. And on the part of the faculty, one of the things that happened was that the appointed director has been arguing that it's not the entire faculty that's actually against the rector and the appointment of the rector. It's a small group within the faculty that is sort of exerting pressure over the rest of the faculty to not recognize the rector.
That's not factually correct, is it?
No, that is not correct at all. No, not at all. Absolutely not. But that's the way in which they've been framing it, and that's the way that they've been servicing it to the pro-government media to basically reframe the events incorrectly. And one of the faculty members particularly was singled out because she is the spouse of the jailed business person Osman Kavala, who is being charged with orchestrating the 2016 coup. First, he was charged with orchestrating the Gezi events, and then because it was not possible to prove the charges, they constantly keep changing the charges because there's really no evidence to support the charges that they're making against him. But he's still jailed. He's been jailed for over a year, perhaps 2 years. Correct me if I'm wrong. So one of the faculty members who's protesting is his spouse. So the government singled out her and said that it's the faculty like her. Again, this is sort of like the way in which they frame any kind of protesters as terrorists by finding these links to alleged people who are suspicious or suspect, and then labeling the entire group as somehow sort of anti-system, anti-national, in order to criminalize and delegitimize the demands that are voiced.
Aisha, what would you add?
This is like a basic strategy of the government that Elif is talking about. It's really to declare a group as terrorist, as one thing, trying to disunite the country, all sorts of discourses that comes with that kind of pointing at someone as a terrorist. And they basically want to show that their actions are legitimate because who they are dealing with are these terrorists who are trying to disunite the country, or they are under the effect of some ill-willed group. So this is like a basic discursive strategy that we have been seeing over and over. I mean, it's really a feature of populism, the polarization in the country, and it works in various ways. I mean, we know that these students are not terrorists. We know that Osman Kavala, who has been in jail, as Elif said, for now, I think actually maybe 3 years, almost 3 years, he's not a terrorist, but it works. I mean, about 50% of the population do not hear the other side of the story. So the media is really under the control of the government. And there's a lot of pressure on people who are trying to traverse these boundaries, try to cross these boundaries and speak to various constituencies. For instance, like a very recent case, Ömer Faruk Gergerlioğlu is an MP from the pro-Kurdish left-leaning HDP, who was also in the circles of the Islamist, political Islamist movement. So in a way, as interlocutors in various groups in the society, and he's working for human rights. And now we see, like very recently, yesterday, he was stripped of his parliament seat for a retweet, basically, you know. I mean, we see this over and over. The government is really trying to divide the society, and that's the only way they could run the show, because we see that their electoral support is decreasing day by day, and these are basically easy tools to change the real agenda. I mean, Turkey is now in the middle of a serious economic crisis. We have been in war in Syria. There's a lot going on, and yet when you look at the pro-government media, just criminalizing students, they're dealing with university elections, you know, that sort of a thing. This is really a strategy of governing the country.
I would add something to that in terms of what it means to label terrorism your opponents, right? So one of the things that happens when you label your opponents coming from anywhere as terrorists is that you refuse to engage them politically. It is basically a way of throwing people outside of the political system. Yesterday, as Ayça said, Ömer Faruk Yargerlioğlu, an MP, was stripped of its MP status. He was, again, illegally, with baseless claims, charged with for retweeting a news item that is still actually up on the news website. He just retweeted it. And because of that, he was charged with aiding and abetting to terrorism. And he was given an over 1 year prison sentence. But that prison sentence had come to a halt because he was elected as an MP. And now what the parliament did was that it stripped Ömer Faruk Yargerlioğlu of the protections that an MP has by stripping him of his title, and which means that he can now go to jail. So what happens is that you're literally throwing an MP whom you have to engage with politically in the National Assembly into jail where you don't have to deal with him anymore and the opposition that he's bringing to the table. In addition to that, yesterday, the state attorney in Turkey filed charges against the party that Ömer Faruk Yargerlioğlu belongs to, HDP, the Kurdish left-leaning political party, to shut down the party. And this is going to be, I don't know, the fifth party or the sixth party in the same sort of political strand that was got shut by the government. This is the third largest political party that is represented in the National Assembly right now. So it does have a large constituency. It got over 6 million votes in the national elections. And by shutting down that political party, what you're doing is that you're refusing to engage with them politically. You're refusing to engage with the challenges, the opposition that it's bringing to the table. So what the government, and not just AKP, but also the ally of AKP, MHP, which is the Nationalist Action Party, the far-right ultra-nationalist party in Turkey, what they're trying to do is that they're trying to craft the political sphere in a way that would serve them in the next elections by basically taking down their opponents who can challenge them in those elections.
And that election is in 2 years from now, isn't it? In 2023?
Yes.
Ayşe?
This is an interesting thing. I mean, we don't know if the party will eventually shut down, but even just starting this criminal court case against the party to be shut down is really, again, going back to what I've said before, is really trying to make sure that those different groups in the society do not support each other. Because what we have seen in 2019 local elections, there was a informal alliance between the main opposition party and the HDP, the one that they're trying to close down. And after a quarter of a century, AKP has been governing in the large cities, the metropolitan cities like Ankara and Istanbul. And with this alliance between the main opposition party and HDP and a smaller nationalist party, they were able to take over the municipalities. So I think in running towards to the 2023 elections, the general elections, the government and its smaller coalition partner, the ultra-nationalist party, they're trying to make sure that this opposition bloc doesn't form again. Because what happens is that when you target a party with terrorism charges, the other parties may become not that enthusiastic to have that election coalition with the HDP. So they're really trying to divide the opposition as well. I mean, or preventing the opposition from getting together to run against the government and the government coalition. They may end up not closing the HDP, but even just charging it with terrorism will help the AKP consolidate its electoral support.
Well, intimidation tactics, and clearly the ruling Justice and Development Party does not wish to see a rerun of what happened in Istanbul 2 years ago, where they lost the mayorship of the city And that was a huge loss for the ruling coalition. As a result of what you said, the fact that these opposition groups actually coalesced in some sort of a front or quasi-coalition. In your article, which is entitled Boğaziçi Resists Authoritarian Control of the Academy in Turkey, co-authored by the both of you, you write that Boğaziçi has a distinctive history and reputation. Elif, can you give us a brief history of the university, which originally opened its doors to students in 1863 as the oldest American college outside of the United States and operated under the name Robert College till 1971. Also, the university is well known for its high academic standards. What are some of these distinct features in terms of its governance structure that are threatened by an authoritarian intervention aiming at establishing a top-down structure of governance?
Boğaziçi shares on paper the legal status of the rest of the universities in Turkey, but it has a particular reputation and it also has particular traditions of governance. So it has a particular reputation that is tied to its history, which, as you said, dates back to Robert College, which was the first American college that was established outside of the United States, and it was founded in 1863. And for more than 100 years, it served as an institution of higher learning for men, and the language of instruction was English, and it mostly attracted the non-Muslim minorities, students from non-Muslim minorities in the Istanbul Ottoman Empire, as well as foreign nationals living under the empire. And then in 1971, after one of the coups that happened in Turkey, it was transferred to the state. All of its property, all of its personnel, everything was transferred to the state, and Robert College was reestablished as Boğaziçi University, as a public university. And it is one of the few public universities that conducts instruction in English language, which is a matter of status. And it is a small university when you compare it to other public universities. It's actually a very small university, which means that it is pretty selective. And it is intentionally so. It's kept as a small university. It doesn't have a law school, for instance. It doesn't have medical schools. For instance, in some other public universities, those are some of the schools that exist, but Boğaziçi doesn't have those. It has a particular niche that it excels at, and it focuses in those areas. In the countrywide university entrance exams, it is preferred by students who are at the very top, who get the top marks in the nationwide university entrance exam. So it gets very, very good students. And it also doesn't have a lot of postgraduate programs, MA, particularly PhD programs. And the underlying implicit sort of thought with that is that it wants to focus its attention and its energy at something that it believes it does the best, which is undergraduate education, with the hope that the undergraduate, if they want to continue their education, will go abroad to get PhDs or postgraduate degrees elsewhere and sort of continue their careers as such. So this is the reputation of Boğaziçi University. When we think about the tradition, the governmental tradition of the university, it has a very egalitarian sort of structure to it. And that is something that is passed upon the newer generation of faculty and administrators from the former ones. So it is something that the faculty who start teaching at Boğaziçi University get inculcated in, and then they kind of like pass this on to the next generation. There are obviously particular positions such as the chairs of the department and the chairs of the schools, such as the School of Social Sciences, which grant MA degrees, for instance. So there is a hierarchical on paper structure, institutionalization, but it doesn't really determine the kind of interactions that take place in the governmental structures at Boğaziçi University. There's a big faculty senate where everything gets discussed. And when a program gets established, it's extensively discussed in many different committees. And then most of the decisions in the university are taken with consensus. That's what it strives for. So it also prides itself on these kind of governmental mechanisms that are not necessarily codified by its legal status, but that is passed on through the culture of teaching at Boğaziçi or serving at Boğaziçi.
Ayşe, let's place the events at Boğaziçi University in a broader context. Since early 2016, academic institutions in Turkey have been subject to a sustained state crackdown that appears to be unprecedented in the history of Turkish Republic, presumably not even under the military junta that came to power in 1980 did we witness such things. I don't know what the pertinent figures are today, but for a period of 2 years, between 2016 and 2018, it was reported that more than 6,000 academics and upward of 1,400 administrative staff from 122 universities were purged, and hundreds of academics were prosecuted. In addition to that, 15 private universities were shut down. Can you talk about this context and the campaign of state repression, as well as its impact on higher education and critical thinking in Turkey?
You're very right in saying that since 2016, what we're witnessing is an unprecedented repression effort to take over the control of universities. I mean, in Turkey, when you look at it historically, the repression or the effort to sort of control universities go together very much with what is happening in the country politically. We have seen after the 1960 coup, 1971 military intervention, and then in 1980 military coup again, we see the academic freedoms are being restricted. But we have never seen this many people, this many faculty members being purged. We have not seen this many students tried in the courts or put in prison. We don't know the exact numbers, but there are thousands of students in jail at the moment. Very much seen like numbers like 70,000. But I looked into it a little bit. Some people who are put in jail become students afterwards, but many of them are just actually university students. This got really worse in 2016 with the failed coup attempt, but we have been seeing it since early 2010. We had the protest in Middle East Technical University, where I graduated from. There were widespread student protests that many students were put in prison. I think their cases were resolved 4 years after the events, and many of them got actual prison sentences, although they have been kept in prison for some time. So we have been seeing this really getting much more stronger will by the government to control universities. And what is also happening is that I just actually recently gave a talk about this. What is interesting in the case of Turkey is that this authoritarianism, or Turkey's fall into this authoritarian regime, overlaps with the expansion of higher education in Turkey. So on the one hand, the government is trying to control the universities like Boğaziçi, where there is faculty who are obviously critical of what has been happening in the country. But there's also this move towards opening new universities and appointing new faculty. And this is like a very fundamental change of the university context in Turkey. And what we are seeing is that what comes with this striking expansion is a serious drop in the quality of education. We see a serious drop in the academic freedoms. We see a serious drop in institutional autonomy. Part of this expansion is very much about the privatization of education, but it's not only the private universities. The government also invested through big business groups, through pro-government, non-profit foundations. There has been a lot of expansion in the private sector as well. But again, who gets to start a university is very much a political decision again. And the Council of Higher Education, which was founded in following the 1980 coup, has been very instrumental to the current government's way of regulating universities. And what is also interesting historically is that when the AKP came to power, one of the things that they said was that they're going to shut down the Council of Higher Education or change its role in the Turkish university system, that they will bring it more as a institution for coordinating universities rather than controlling universities. But what we have seen is that the council became really the major mechanism in how they are controlling, trying to take over the university administrations. I should also add, in relation to the Boğaziçi case, but also in relation to other universities, is that we are seeing more and more that the AKP is appointing political figures to these university positions. Like in the case of Mr. Bulu, the new rector of Boğaziçi, he has been a member of the governing party. He ran and lost in 2015 elections. And I don't know to what extent this is true, but I've definitely seen various reporting on his role in the AKP's election campaigns and Twitter, where he was basically organizing the social media efforts of the party. And we have seen that, for instance, last year, Twitter closed down various accounts that are related, that are basically fraud accounts. They're not real accounts. It's kind of a propaganda machine of the party. And there is reporting about how this new president of the university was actually also playing a major role in that effort. And as I said, Boğaziçi is not the only one. I mean, we have seen various former AKP parliamentarians being appointed as rectors of universities. And one of the things that is wrong about this is in the law, university administrators cannot be members of political parties. Faculty can be a member of a political party, but the deans, the director of institutes, or as I said, the president, cannot have a party affiliation. So clearly what they're doing is against the law. And all these different illegal, I would say, appointments are to make sure that universities are basically not causing trouble to the government, but also promoting its political agenda, as well as I said, educational agenda.
And that's Shahram Aghamir speaking with Ayça Alamdurulu, the Associate Director of the Program on Turkey and Research Scholar at the Center on Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, about the Turkish government's assault on institutions of higher education. We're also speaking with Elif Babul, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Mount Holyoke College. We'll hear more after a short break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Let's discuss the reasons behind Mr. Erdogan's recent decision concerning Boğaziçi University. He directly appointed a new rector at the university and issued a decree at midnight on February 5th to establish two schools at the university, clearly with the intention of appointing pro-government faculty in order to pack the university. In the MERIP article, your explanation for these decisions is twofold. First, you point out Mr. Erdogan's strategy of bringing autonomous institutions to heel to suppress dissent and the desire by